Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guests today are Tim Bagwell, Dr. Tim Bagwell, and Steve Wingfield, who is running as a Green for Congress in the 19th Congressional District. So if Mr. Delgado would like to come on and talk about student loan forgiveness, I would be happy to talk to him about that. So, well, we're going to talk about student loan forgiveness. So, gentlemen, you have the floor.
Somebody else start. Tim, start. Somebody, let's.
No, I'll let the green guys start out because they need all he can get.
Okay. You know, well, we came here today specifically to talk about some proposals that Donald Trump has been making to, I guess, from his perspective, to conserve very tiny fragmentary percentages of the federal budget connected to student loan finance for people who need it. It's kind of a fascinating concept to look at it because he's proposing a $5 trillion budget. You know, no, it's not discussed very much in public. The scale of the numbers that we're talking about, you know, and I'm all for the idea of controlling taxes and controlling the budget. But when you have a $5 trillion budget, you need to find some things that you can cut from some of your things that cost $500 billion or $1 trillion or more a year, not things that cost, you know, $18 billion. So you're sort of just taking your dust feather out around the edges of this giant elephant in your living room. And so the I guess the main thing that people are focusing on is specifically a program that has facilitated people going into public service, government jobs, school teachers, firefighters, et cetera, that if you've made your payments for, you know, in a timely manner for a certain amount of time, I think you get 25% of your repayment time forgiven. So you pay back for 75% of the schedule, and then you get that last little bit forgiven. And this is actually not, you know, an anti-poverty program. This is not a debt forgiveness program that was designed to get more people to be able to afford to go to college. This is weird. This is a program that was designed to encourage people to go into the public sector, into jobs where your career growth, your salary growth is largely dependent on time served rather than merit promotions. Although there is some degree in some fields that involve merit promotions, but as a general rule, it's about time in. And so what they're doing with this program, the reason it exists, is not just to encourage people to go into public service, but to stay in public service. To stay in public service long enough to qualify for this forgiveness of the final 25% of your repayment schedule, and become an experienced teacher, an experienced firefighter, you know, an experienced someone who's good at it, and will then transfer those skills to others coming in. So I don't really understand anything outside of spite that goes into any recommendation that's made by Donald Trump. We see that time and time again, but this to me carries the appearance of looking for ways to create the impression to his most hardcore base, the Tea Party people and the libertarians about federal spending, to create the impression that some kind of controls are being put on federal spending, even though we're facing a $1.1 trillion federal deficit this year. That's actually double the last deficit under Obama. That if he generates enough buzz and enough conversation around these tiny fragmentary savings that he's trying to achieve, that maybe people won't notice that he's doubled the deficit, you know, in such a short time in office. And then, of course, missing from the equation, what's always missing from the equation whenever we talk about public spending of any kind, is what's being purchased with that money that will no longer be available if that money is cut. And in this case, what's not going to be available anymore is the very federal employees and state and local employees that do the kind of work that we require to keep our civilization functioning. I'm going to emphasize again, firefighters are among the professions that would now be disqualified from this. And, you know, one house burns down, and that's already, you know, 30 times the value of the debt forgiveness for the firefighter in the last 5 years that he or she was paying back debt. So it's a phenomenal concept. And of course, obviously a terrible and counterproductive concept, but we're in a strange time right now that I'm sure we can all agree based on what we see every day. We're a strange time right now where government decisions are being formulated by people who do not have the qualifications to understand the math underlying the various things that they're approaching. And they're recommending highly destructive and counterproductive proposals.
I agree. I agree with Steve. It's in forever, in fact, since the creation of the program. It's been a case of there's a con aspect to it. Now, look over here, and I'm taking care of all those people who I'm not taking care, but I'm policing all the people who are benefiting, all the individual loan applicants, and making sure that they're not taking money that they don't deserve. And it's a distraction, and the dollars are so small, but a distraction to the voter, distraction to the voters who didn't apply for the student loans, who there's a sort of an adage that why should they forgive student loans? You know, if I would have known they were going to forgive them, I would have done it too. We're well past that with the number of people who have student loans. It's such a huge number of the voters, and all these programs, these forgiveness programs, are still handed out as if they're doing somebody a favor, as if the government is doing a favor to someone when all along they've been dealing with this with the growing debt. So the con aspect works in real well with the current milieu. You know, take care of these little numbers, use it as a distraction, and fund a war or two in the meantime.
So what's really happening is happening throughout the budget, not just in these student loan proposals. By the way, the Parent Plus loan program is also proposed for big cuts, and I think we should get back to that in a second. But obviously what's happening is that you're dealing with people who are blowing up the budget. They are personally blowing up the budget at levels that we haven't seen since the Reagan administration. And it's kind of important to correlate that to the Reagan administration, because there's such a gulf, such a paradox, really. It's not even a gulf, between the rhetoric of your so-called budget hawk political candidates and what actually happens when people who are interested in low public budgets elect those people, that I don't know why that's not the only thing that the mainstream media is talking about. You know, Ronald Reagan ran for office in 1980 claiming that he would end federal deficits and that he would go so far as to try to promote a balanced budget amendment that would make it illegal for the federal government to exceed annual revenues, which, by the way, we have in New York State. We don't go into debt annually in New York State, outside of the bonding system. But, in the 8 years that Reagan was president, the national debt tripled, and it was peacetime. We didn't have any wars during the years that, that was World War II level federal spending explosion. So the reason he did that, of course, was that he was, again, just as Trump is doing, he was expanding the military, but he was also blowing up federal spending so that the GDP would look good, even though his Reaganomics policies, his supply side policies, had caused the economy to go into a deep recession in 1982, and he was trying to get the numbers up. And we're looking at the same thing. People don't realize that the federal budget is part of GDP. You can make it look like GDP is going up, by jacking up federal spending, because it's included in the numbers. And all of that debt that they're incurring is basically bringing future dollars into the current GDP numbers. And so that's really what's happening once again. We've got somebody who's claiming to be a budget hawk. And so what they do with the budgeting process is that they find hundreds of little nickel and dime items, and they publish this so it appears as a campaign tactic that they're really finding every nickel, every wasted nickel in the budget. Look, I found wasted nickels in 175 different programs. Yeah, except you jacked up 20 times that much money into just one program, you know, into the military. And it's easy to get that over on an angry base. Although, why the focus? If I were on Fox News, and I were trying to practice legitimate conservative journalism, all I would be talking about is that $1.1 trillion deficit, and that the proposals to make cuts are public relations scams and the exact opposite of the direction the budget's actually going.
So, Tim, I was going to chime in.
Go ahead.
You talked the other day about the student loan forgiveness, and you were saying about all of Trump's bankruptcies, and that same concept he's not sharing with other people.
Right, we've talked about bankruptcy as a solution before, and of course, most of his bankruptcies, I don't think were personal, but rather corporate, but still, corporations and now we're citizens. considered citizens. The bankruptcy laws have been removed from the protection from student loans have been removed from the protection of bankruptcy laws. And like I said, we've gone over that a number of times. But just the equity in that alone, they talk about it as if, and Warren and both Bernie have talked about complete forgiveness for all student loans or largely. It's kind of a jubilee. The thing about the excuse me for a second. Got my thoughts here. The bankruptcies, allowing bankruptcy allows the individual borrower to decide whether or not they want to file a bankruptcy or not. It's not as if everyone is wiped down. That's a big deal in the Treasury. Just restoring bankruptcy itself allows it to come into the bankruptcy courts and be considered. And the individual consumers decide when they file bankruptcy. And this kind of I don't know what the numbers would be, but it certainly is equitable and it's supportable in terms of the argument is supportable in terms of not everyone's going to file for bankruptcy. I think actually everyone should be qualified. I believe in the elimination of student loans because the drag on the economy. They should be forgiven across the board. Myself, but the just simply allowing bankruptcy would give us some equity. It needs to at least be restored to give equity back into the system, regardless of what happens to the rest of the program right now. Bankruptcy needs to be restored as a form of protection. And student loans need to be treated the same as consumer loans, since they're not, they're not secured by property. Get back to that, and then, you can then assess again how much need to be forgiven in their entirety.
Right.
To free the lending.
There is one more element that's happening among these proposals for elements of student loans to be put on the chopping block, which actually is the thing that we were talking about before, which is the actual prevention of people being able to pursue higher education. And that's the Parents Plus program. The Parents Plus program is basically a way for people like me, in my late 50s, whose house is paid off, and so I have some equity that I could borrow against in case I don't want my children to leave college, $50,000 in debt if they go to graduate school, $100,000 in debt, because I have equity that I've saved up over all these years, and I can take out a loan of a much higher levels, and that's something that parents have been doing to try to facilitate their own children's transition into adulthood. And this is the kind of thing that we were, always encouraged. If you live prudently and you don't live beyond your means, right, you can buy a small house, and the money that you're putting into repaying that house becomes your own equity instead of rent to a landlord, right? You play by the rules your whole life. And so what they're talking about now is capping the amount that older people, that parents can borrow, theoretically to reduce the rate at which, failure to repay sometimes happens. But when you do that, what you're doing is you're telling people, middle-income people who own their own homes, who have steady incomes, that their kids aren't going to college, you know, because if we're not simultaneously doing something to make at least public colleges tuition free so that people can go to college, now you're saying your kids can't go to college. You played by the rules your whole life. You're trying to continue to be a supportive parent and take on the debt that would otherwise go to your children who are at a zero income level of their lives at this time. But due to the average default rate, you know, we don't know anything about you personally, but due to the average default rate across the economy, we've decided that you aren't eligible to borrow that much money anymore. And that is also something that we have to face in terms of, you know, as well as the burden that the current, you know, $1.5 trillion is placing on the economy, that if we're actually calculating ways for people who have played by the rules and lived solid, well-budgeted middle-class lives their whole lives are now being told that college costs X amount of dollars, but we're only going to allow you to borrow Y amount of dollars. And so the rest is going to have to go on your kid or not be borrowed at all, and your kid's not going to college. This too, boy, what a spite-driven thing, you know? What a it boggles my mind every time that I ponder how many of these decisions make so much the opposite of the economic sense in which they're being presented, and are punitive against people who actually lived prudent and moderate lives, not just the poor, right? We're accustomed to people being punitive against the poor. That's ancient news. But, you know, a proposal like this, punishing people who played by the rules and succeeded at that over the course of their lives, and telling them, okay, well, we're pulling the rug out from under you now. Now even your kids aren't going to college. And the spite, the pure superficiality of it, it pains me. I don't know any way to say it. Like, I actually feel emotional pain when I contemplate this, because my parents were those, they were lower middle class. They lived that prudent life. They lived below their means. I'm, you know, 58 years old right now, one kid in college, two more on the way. And my wife and I have played by the rules and lived below our means. And you know, we paid off our house early. We're all ready to go. And to hear this kind of conversation right now with people pretending that there's some kind of federal budget sense underlying it, as if there are no cascading effects, either socially or economically, it's just, like I said, it's economic, that it's invalid economically is you know, visible on the face of it. But the other element is you know, I actually feel pain emotionally when I hear these kinds of proposals.
Tim, you did your PhD thesis on the student loan debt problem. I believe it was in the early 2000s. So from the time you finished your thesis to now, how much worse is the problem?
How much what?
Worse.
Worse. She's asking how much worse is the problem. We do have
It seems like when the government tries to fix something, they break it further. And moving it more towards the federal to federal lending has just made it worse. It makes it. The courts had always treated student loan lenders and student loan guarantors before the move to the federal government as if they were, all that money was federal money. This was part of the framework of taking away all these consumer protections, was that all the money was federal money. You know, if it was, even though it was given out to institutions to lend to borrowers, it was always treated in the context of this is federal money. So, in order to protect that federal money, we've got to suppress and control the population that we're lending to with the restrictions that they would otherwise have under credit cards or under equity loans, things like that. So they stigmatize the borrower, and they use that as a way to justify these controls and these punitive controls. And that has not really changed under this program, except that it makes it even more of a federal issue. And it's interesting. You just have to go back to, and I think what you know, there are certain defense is completely off the board for discussion. You know, unless you have the $10,000 hammer, however much that hammer costs. they've taken so much. The media does it too. They take the defense budget items completely off the board, and then it's all this emphasis on the spending on the individual, and that framework, which is a conservative agenda, not a full discussion of all the options for federal spending, and so that the student loan is. Nothing really changed in terms of the borrower, except the borrower's got more debt and less ability to make plans for the future.
Right. I'd like to just make a recommendation. This has been something that I've incorporated into my own life since, I don't know, I think probably since 1980 when I was studying under Seymour Melman at Columbia on the military budget, is that I don't use the word defense when I talk about the military budget because, you know, when you have 800 military bases in 130 countries and nobody's actually attacking any American territory or threatening to attack American territory, then you're pretty clear that that's not really a defense budget. I mean, some small amount of it, maybe the intelligence gathering process to make sure that another 9/11 isn't in process right now or something that would attack the American soil, and some limited amount of defense, you know, a deterrent level of defense, because people will tend not to attack you if they know that the response would be in the form of overwhelming force, right? So you maintain some kind of deterrent level budget. But obviously what we're doing with our military is a constabulary function around the world, maintaining political structures that are supportive of the neoliberal corporate investment practices that are happening throughout the world. And that's why we have, you know, a $1.4 trillion military budget. It's not the $750 billion that people keep saying. We also, whenever we talk about the military budget, we need to remember that the nuclear weapons program is in the Department of Energy. We need to remember that the Veterans Administration, now something like $250 billion a year, is what ordinary accounting would refer to as a legacy cost. Right, you're taking care of your employees as part of the operation. Obviously, Homeland Security and other intelligence operations are part of the military budget. Many other things. You throw that our transfers of weapons to foreign allies are done through the State Department. They're not even in the Pentagon's budget. They're in the State Department's budget. So you throw all that together, and we have $1.4 trillion. And so what we're seeing. And this is actually a nonpartisan thing, right? This budget and the number of bases and the number of overseas operations going on go up no matter which party is in power. Like, yeah, sure, George Bush invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, but then Barack Obama invaded, you know, Libya and Yemen and started all the wars in Central Africa that started this. And the Democrats all just agreed right now to vote to create the Space Force. $2 billion to initiate the onset of a space force while 27 million Americans don't have any health insurance. You know, while there's $1.5 trillion, people say, well, where are you going to get the money? Where are you going to? Why didn't anyone stop and ask where we're going to get the money to pay for a space force? Boy, is that ever an imaginary threat, you know, that, you know, so the budget out there exists. And what's happening right now is that more and more, the military snake is feeding on its own tail. It is being allowed to consume not just, you know, two-thirds or more of the discretionary spending that we have available in the budget every year, but obviously by extension of that two-thirds of the deficit, two-thirds of the new federal debt that we're picking up every year. And that by extension means that it's picking up two-thirds of the interest payments on the federal debt that we're picking up every year. And at some point, we have to say to ourselves, can we stop talking about these nickel and dime issues a little bit? Stop using the word defense, because when we use the word defense, we're sort of acknowledging or at least propelling the notion that this spending is being done for an important reason. It's being done for national defense. We don't want anyone attacking us. We want to win. If we get attacked by by, you know, Nazi Germany or, you know, Japan invades Pearl Harbor, we're going to respond. Like, that's not what this budget is about, you know, and we need to call it a military budget, you know, and not a defense budget, because that's where you're going to find all the money that's missing. That's where you're going to find all the new debt that's being incurred. That's where you're going to find all the interest payments on the debt that's being incurred. And I'm going to raise a controversial point right now, which is that I personally believe, I don't even think it's a belief, I mean, I can certify this statistically, is that with consumer spending not being an option for investors with large cash reserves to make significant returns on investment, that federal debt, which is guaranteed, is really one of the best ways for people of high net worth who have substantial cash reserves sitting around to keep their money in a place where it's going to keep on growing. So what's actually happening is that we taxpayers are being forced to subsidize an investment instrument for people who have so much cash reserves that they can't even find anything in the consumer economy that they could invest into that would give them a better rate of return. And that's why we continue to expand public debt.
We only have a couple of minutes. We only have a couple of minutes left, and I'm sorry, but I had given Zach Garofalo the wrong number. So Zach is now on the call. So hi, Zach. I'm sorry for my mistake.
That's fine.
You?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Hey, Zach.
So we have like 2 minutes left, and I'm sorry for my mistake. And, you know, if you want to add anything to, you know, the discussion about student loan forgiveness, you have a minute to do so.
Oh, don't worry about it. And, you know, since I'm just joining, I don't really have anything at this time, but it was nice to listen to Steve, although looking forward to listening to the entire recording, because I'm not sure where I was picking up.
I just want to add one thing that Steve was saying, and that whenever they say, how are we going to pay for Medicare for All? Military budget. How are we going to pay to get forgiveness of student loan? Military budget. And without really even affecting the military budget. Probably.
Yeah, because you're talking about like this, for example. It's an $18 billion proposed cut, and with the military budget being $1.4 trillion, yeah, you could cut that and not even affect the military budget.
Yeah. And the other thing is that all those bases and all those commitments represent continued risk, expanded risk of war.
Right, of course, right, because you're occupying 130 countries, and there are going to be people there that don't want that.
So, unfortunately, we're out of time, and we will continue this discussion. So you have been listening to Tim Bagwell, Dr. Tim Bagwell, Steve Greenfield, and a fast hello to my friend Zach Garofalo. So we will continue this discussion at a later date. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And thank you, guys, for participating in the conversation. Have a great day.
You too. Thank
you. Good luck with your campaign, Steve. Good luck.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.